I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. Hey, welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm your host, Howard Jacobson, and you're listening to show number 84. So the advertising industry often tries to get us to buy things by associating their products with stuff we want, with stuff we desire, with traits we want. So, for example, Procter & Gamble will get us to buy Tide by associating it with being a good parent, specifically a good mother, taking care of our children. They'll get us to buy diamonds so that we can show commitment and love. They'll get us to buy certain types of beer to show that we're attractive and fun. And, you know, the list goes on, from cars to clothes to food to pretty much everything. There's an attempt to link an entire holistic lifestyle to this one thing that we can buy. Because I might not be able to become, you know, hot and sexy, but I can buy Budweiser, which in my mind will do the same thing. So this has happened to the Mediterranean diet as well. The Mediterranean diet traditionally is one of the healthiest diets on the planet, a fact that's been known to researchers since right after World War II when Ansel Keys first took a look at the inhabitants of Crete. So fast forward 60 years, and what has happened is the Mediterranean diet has become a brand, and instead of trying to eat the way the Mediterranean people traditionally ate, we've been sold a couple of things that are supposed to give us all the benefits of the Mediterranean diet without actually eating the Mediterranean diet. And those things are, of course, olive oil, wine, and fish. And it's true that all three are consumed in a Mediterranean diet, but my guest today argues that the Mediterranean diet's success in keeping people healthy and living a long time comes in spite of those three elements rather than because of them. So today's guest, Juliana Hever, is a registered dietitian, the plant-based dietitian. She is the author of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Plant-Based Nutrition. She is a co-conspirator of Chef AJ in the webcast The Chef and the Dietitian. And she's got a new book called The Vegetarian Diet. And what she does through her knowledge of nutrition and her knowledge of history is show us what the real Mediterranean diet consisted of and how to bring the delicious flavors of that diet into our lives without falling prey to the mistaken notion that simply adding half a cup of olive oil and a glass of red wine at dinner is going to give us those health benefits. So without further ado, Juliana Hever, welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast.
Thank you, Howard. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're of a very select group of repeat guests. So I think you're my second timer. So this is very exciting for me.
Oh, I feel special. Thank you.
Yeah, now I get to call you a regular when I name drop.
I love it. So, I'm honored.
So you just released a new book, and I'd like you to say the title because I've been having trouble saying it right.
Oh, it's so fun to say, but it took me so many times to practice. Okay, ready?
Yep.
It's The Vegetarian Diet.
Got it. So Vegetarian.
Exactly. Yeah, okay. It's a hybridization of vegan and Mediterranean.
Awesome. So my first question is, why did you write this book?
That's a good question. Well, okay. I am very passionate, as you know and as you are, about plant-based diets, and I've considered them the gold standard in the research, but everyone always seems to go back to these wonderful studies that were coming out on the Mediterranean diet, and they hold true. I mean, they're consistently coming out with new research on it, and it is consistent in the literature to have a positive effect on minimizing chronic disease risk and improving, you know, quality of life longer. There's been a lot of wonderful studies to come out of the Med. So my question was, well, why is that? How can we have both? You know, because you can't really, I didn't know, I wanted to really delve in and find out exactly what was it about the Mediterranean diet that makes it so successful. And I wanted to, of course, see how plant-based it was. And so I did this really deep, fascinating delve into the research from first from ancient Greece and then, you know, all the Ansel Keys stuff. And then the big study in Crete by Leland Alba in the 50s. And I put it all together and I was like, okay, this makes perfect sense. And then the thesis of the book was born that the reason the Mediterranean diet is indeed so successful is because it is a whole food plant-based diet at its essence.
So, and we'll get into that, into the nutritional aspects of it, because that's your gig, right? A registered dietitian. What was it about the Mediterranean that drew you personally? Was it just that this stuff was in the news, or do you have personal fondnesses and affinities for the regions, the people, the cuisines?
Yeah, well, clearly you've read the book, because I'm passionate about all things Mediterranean. I there's many countries that border the Med. There's conflicting evidence. There's 18 or 25. There's a whole bunch of countries. And so I admitted in the, in the foreword, in the introduction, that I have this passion and obsession with Italy, all things Italian. So I took it from the Italian angle just because of my love for Italy and Italian food and Italian culture. And so I used a lot of Italian language and plays on words and stuff throughout, they just peppered throughout the book. But indeed, of course, it does encompass, Middle Eastern countries, just a whole bunch of different countries. It wasn't just Italy. So I've always studied, I studied Greek and Roman art and literature and drama. I was an actress. I was a Shakespearean actress. I played Juliet. And so I've always loved everything Italian. I went there after college. My parents took me and my sister as our finishing our college gift. And it was the best trip of my life. I loved everything about Italy. And I've been to the Mediterranean a couple times. I had to do a cruise last year to speak on it for work for me. And that's when I actually wrote the table of contents for this book, because, the food is so good. I was in Greece and I was in Turkey, and I just fell in love with that kind of cuisine as well. So yes, I had a whole personal bias going in also, but it just kind of all perfectly came together where I got to incorporate the food and I got to play in the kitchen for a long time. It was a lot of work to modify the recipes and take out the oil and the meats and all that. But so I got to indulge in the food and in all the culture. And then I talked about Plato and Aristotle, and it was just such an amazing, fascinating study for me over the last year and a half.
Sounds like tough, but somebody had to do it, huh?
Exactly. Yes.
Cool. I think you need to go back and figure out whether it is 18 or 20 countries that border the Med. I think this requires another trip or two to get those facts really nailed down.
I should go to every one of those countries and count them up. I think that's a great idea. that's what I keep saying, is that I hope somehow this book gets me back there. That's my goal. Uh-huh. That was my deep goal.
Well, when you were traveling there and doing the cruise, did you have a chance to sort of, meet with locals and get a sense of their relationship to their food?
I did very little, not enough, because it was a cruise ship. So we had 4 days really. And, And one day it was totally raining and we had a tour. But one day when we went to Turkey, Ephesus, Turkey, and I was with my mom. She was my date on this cruise. She was nice enough to come along with me and keep me company. But she's actually a really fun traveling buddy. So we went to this restaurant, and at first we were in the car going around. And the tour guide was like, oh, you'll never find anything vegan. Forget it. Because we're trying to explain, you know, with the language barrier, you know, vegetables, no meat, no dairy. I'm trying to explain to him. And he's like, oh, good luck with that. So I found that the opposite was true. It was beyond easy to find these meals that were, you know, and I mean, like my plate was stacked really high with delicious options, like so many different foods at every restaurant. But in particular, when we went to Ephesus and we found this amazing restaurant that was like hidden, and you know, we sat outside by this creek, but the guy who welcomed us in, and I was trying to explain to him vegan, you know, vegetarian, oh, let me get mama. It was like called Mama's Kitchen. And he goes and gets his mom, who's, she's the chef, and it's her kitchen. And she was so excited. And she's like, oh, and she takes me to the big buffet. And she's like, you could have this and this and this. And she's pointing out everything. And me and my mom, it was like one of the best meals I've ever had. It was just incredible. And so she even had a cookbook there. So I bought her cookbook, and I actually took some of those recipes and modified them and incorporated them into the book. So I got to talk to them in a little bit, you know, obviously there's a language barrier, but it was kind of fun to see how the locals eat. So I was eating with the locals every time when we were on land those 4 days, and the food was just extraordinary. Mm.
So one thing I'm wondering is that there's a tendency that I've seen in sort of the food community, people who care about food issues, whether it's, you know, plant-based people or vegans or paleo or Atkins or whatever, to want to create distinctions and to create hierarchies, that this is better than that and that's better than the other thing. And I see in your book and a couple others recently a real sort of both-and approach. And I, you know, I love the title because it's a fun sort of play on words between vegan and Mediterranean. But was there something about that in particular that drew you to it, to kind of create a synthesis to say we don't have to fight about whether the vegan diet or the Mediterranean diet is the healthiest one?
Absolutely. I mean, the whole essence of the book, the whole essence of everything I do work-wise with lectures, with writing, I'm always trying to open up the gates and welcome everyone in, because really I just want more people eating more plants and fewer or no animal products and processed foods. And that reaches into all the healthy diets. If you look at all the healthy diets, you know, everyone can agree that we need to eat more fruits and vegetables. Everyone can agree that animal products are not health promoting. There's just like really no arguments if you look at it from a really broad, unbiased perspective. And it's just like when people try to get niche like paleo and all that, where it's like, no, you have to have this and it's grass fed and blah, blah, blah. That's when I think we get into this exclusivity and people are A, turned off, B, intimidated, C, they delve in and then either, you know, are sucked into it and that becomes what they define themselves as. But really, ultimately, from a health perspective, there are so many ways. It is very open and it doesn't have to be exclusive. But of course, one of my main arguments in this book is the main difference between the Mediterranean classically and the vegetarian is that we have, you know, environmental and ethical considerations that we have to face now in 2015 that we can no longer ignore in order for us to, you know, to survive. And I bring in those arguments because, you know, people could argue, yeah, we eat grass-fed beef, and if you have a small dose of that, then you could still be healthy. But really, we can't do that for other reasons other than our health, in addition to our health. So with wanting to be all-encompassing and open, I still want people to be aware of all the other issues that are associated with what we eat.
Well, I guess one of the big themes of the book is to look at things holistically. And so when you talk, you don't just talk about the vegetarian diet, you talk about the whole, you know, the Mediterranean lifestyle that includes fresh air, exercise, being outside, taking your time and enjoying meals and making each one a festive occasion. You're not just telling us live our crazy Western lives and just eat from this, you know, from this column of food and everything will be fine, right?
Exactly. It's absolutely holistic. And, you know, and I understand, believe me, I live in the middle of crazy Los Angeles. I've got two kids. I work full time. I understand how it's not possible to have, you know, family meals three times a day and to really like cook everything from scratch like I wish we all could. And I obviously that is ideal, and that is a part of why the research is so strong in the Mediterranean. But that being said, I think we could all try a little bit of, you know, I introduce a lot of different ways to incorporate some of those habits into our lives and integrate them, even though despite our crazy schedules and our hectic lifestyles, it is possible to implement mindfulness and to schedule in exercise because it is so important. And all of those things come into play for optimal health and for, you know, for everything. Like if you really want to have a quality of life, everything matters. I think diet is number one most important, but like you said, you can't just fix, you know, eat these foods and everything's going to be perfect, because how you eat them and what else you do around your life is very important as well. And that's, you know, like one of my favorite books is The Blue Zones. Mm-hmm. And it talks all about that, about how, you know, the regions with the most centenarians around the world, they do all have in common these certain factors, these, you know, socialization, you know, strong social and sense of belonging. They have, you know, they do eat plant-centered diets. They do, you know, they eat in a calm environment. They do stuff that's a lot of movement and activity. They're not sedentary. They're just certain things that around the world are kind of like almost universal law for being healthy. And so I try to incorporate ways to implement those things despite, you know, our common technology and crazy schedules and, you know, life at a desk, just lifestyles that we've turned into in modern day.
Right. Well, yeah, as I'm listening to you, it reminds me a little bit about the idea of keeping kosher. So I grew up in a Jewish home. We didn't keep kosher, but I knew a lot of people who did. So I was able to sort of look at it as a, you know, a sort of a cultural artifact that I wasn't wedded to. And what I saw is that those kind of rules actually tended to create the community around them. When you took your food seriously, then you had to create community that was able to support it. You had to have enough people living together that you could have, you know, your kosher butcher. You know, you'd have meals together. Certain types of the demands of the food created a certain culture. And I'm thinking that for people who are serious about being plant-based, it's hard. You know, it's possible. But most people who are plant-based at some point start cooking for themselves, start doing some of the things that you talk about in the chapter on sort of, you know, nuts and bolts of like stocking the pantry. That there's something about taking on the food that can tend to spread out and kind of colonize other areas of our lives.
Absolutely. No, it is. It's really kind of a beautiful thing if you think about it. I like the synergy. I talk a lot about synergy in there. And I bring up, of course, your book a lot based on the whole synergistic principles. But there's synergy not within just our food and nutrients. There's synergy within our communities and our relationship to nature and the food that we eat. And there's just such a broader perspective from a synergistic viewpoint that I love. Like, I love that. Yeah, it's like we are what we eat, and who we are has to do with who we are around and how we live our lives and how we connect with other people.
So one of the things that really struck me, the section on synergy, you have a whole page on sofrito, right?
Yes.
So first, tell us what sofrito is.
Okay, sofrito is basically a classic, it's kind of like a marinara sauce. And it's classic to Spain, or is it Italy or Spain? I'm blanking on it, but it's like a marinara sauce. And what's so cool about it is that I use it as an example because there's so many wonderful things within the standard ingredients that work together to make it really healthy. Like, you know, like the carotenoids are cooked, like it's a cooked tomato, and that the cooked tomatoes are very powerful antioxidants, right, and protect against prostate cancer and all that. And so the heat of it does that. And then you've got the different nutrients in there. What else is in there? Is there something green in there? Something with iron in there that is brought about by the vitamin C in the tomatoes. And they're just all these wonderful synergistic principles within just this one classic sauce that everyone puts on their spaghetti, you know, and it's just kind of something that's been, we all use it in different recipes, different versions of it. But there's also like the fat in the, they use in olive oil, but I made an oil-free version with, I used olives, but the olive oil, the fat in there, synergizes to help absorb those carotenoids even better too. So it's like all these different things within one simple sauce, is a synergy example.
Right. And you'd imagine that every traditional society that's been around for thousands and thousands of years has stumbled upon ways to make their food optimally healthy. That, you know, that I would trust a tradition that old before I would trust, you know, Kellogg's spraying pills on breakfast cereal.
Exactly. And I don't even think that was the intention to provide the optimal nutrition. It's just like the way we always cook. And that's my big argument too. I really, my ultimate overarching goal for this book was to put nutrition and diet into historical and global context. And that's why I went back to ancient Greece and Rome and talked about how, you know, there are these principles were started then, you know, let thy food be thy medicine be thy food. That's an old, you know, Hippocratic statement, where people were connecting food and health. And then, of course, I talk about the whole history of how cardiovascular disease came to be seen as something that can be moderated or some kind of correlated to our diets. And it's fascinating to watch how that emerged. And I document that. Actually, I documented it in great detail, and they cut a lot of it out because I guess it's kind of boring for some people. I love that stuff. But historically, it was very interesting the way we've came to understand our relationship between nutrition and health. And it's so funny because even now in 2015, there are so many physicians that don't know about this or don't accept the fact that nutrition is that powerful and it really can be medicinal. But in fact, we've been talking about that since the beginning of time. So it's interesting.
So the thing that really struck me about the sofrito, aside from the, it's a great example of a synergistic, holistic food that serves on so many purposes, but what really struck me was that it had olive oil in it. And you have a really interesting, nuanced take on oil in this book. You present a fair amount of information that would seem to suggest that certain types of oils, olive oil, in particular, may be okay for some people in some circumstances. And you also caution against sort of adding it willy-nilly and better to have it as a whole food. And your recipes don't have oil. Can you talk a little bit about where you landed? Because you did write in the book that it was the most complicated thing to write about.
Yeah, I think everyone was laughing at me like, oh, right, you're going to take the olive oil out of the Mediterranean. What are you, crazy? Like, that's ridiculous. It is it's synonymous with the Mediterranean diet. And I went in there, honestly, very open-minded because I've always taught, you know, oil-free cooking and eating, because with my clients and over the last few years, I've seen the less oil people consume, the easier it is to maintain weight for a lot of people. But so I went in there with that bias, but I said, you know what, why, maybe that is why the Mediterranean diet is so successful. Let me look. And boy, did I look. And it was great because Dr. Greger, Michael Greger, who I just, you know, adore, he's the walking encyclopedia. He gave me a whole bunch of articles on this too. So I had so much to look at, and I really wanted to be objective. I really, because I knew if I was going to claim that you don't need the olive oil, I needed to defend why, and I needed to really have that answer. But I wasn't going in there saying, oh, I'm going to figure out why it's not good. I'm going to figure out if it really is necessary. And when I really dug in, and what I really, and when I incorporate what I've learned from elsewhere and from with my clients and from other research, I found that perhaps the Mediterranean diet is successful in spite of the olive oil, not because of it. And that is one of the three myths that I debunk on the Mediterranean diet. And my biggest argument goes back to that. And it looks like it, like, so there's certain people that, even if you look at the older studies where they were consuming olive oil, they were still consuming a lot fewer calories than we consume now. And they needed more calories because, like in Crete, for example, with that original study, they didn't have enough food. It was just a war-torn country, and it was like they were just coming out of, you know, World War II, and you know it got really shredded in the war, and it was very hard for this population. It was going through a lot of struggles to get food on the table, and olive oil. They had olive trees and everything, and it was easy. It was an easy source of calories for them. But now, fast forward to nowadays, we have the opposite problem. We have too many calories going in, and we're trying to figure out how to modify the amount of caloric intake that the majority of the population is taking in, which is why one out of three people in the world are overweight or obese, and two out of three in America are overweight or obese. So clearly we do not need to get more calories in. With that being said, there are certain populations like those that are, you know, trying to gain weight, or those that are athletes that are burning thousands of calories, that could get away with having it. And they have really good cholesterol levels. They can get away with having some oil. But the majority of people are trying to lose weight, or at least maintain their weight, or trying to lower their blood cholesterol levels. And for them, the olive oil is absolutely unnecessary. It is a processed food. If you can go to the original olives, and I have a chart in there comparing nutritionally the difference between the intact olive and the olive oil, and you see that you're just basically removing fiber and a bulk of nutrients and adding it, and it's just pure fat. And we just don't need that much fat, the majority of the population. So that was my conclusion. And so I decided to stick with what I do anyway, and I did all of my recipes completely oil-free.
Yeah, and I love the nuance in there, in that, you know, each of us has to look at our own lives in context. That we don't just say, oh, those people in Crete eat this way, so we should too, or right. So that we're not just copying blindly. You know, I don't know if your kids ever liked the Amelia Bedelia books.
I did.
big favorites in my household, where Amelia Bedelia just takes everything literally. And the way we in America, we hop on diet bandwagons. We see, this group in the Caucasus Mountains lives to 102, and they happen to eat yak yogurt. So let's all go out and buy Danon.
Exactly.
I love that you create context, that we can make decisions based on our own situation and our own goals. And there's a way in which olive oil is natural, and there's a way in which in our society, for most people, it's an unnatural thing to add.
Exactly. I think I always recommend going individualized and really looking at what works for you, because for some people, they can totally get away with having oil, and, you know, it's not worth it to fight that everyone needs one way of being, because it's just not true. It's just not true. I mean, we have overarching principles, like the fact that, you know, if you're eating lots of whole plant foods and you're getting all of your nutrients, then you're going to do better, you know, or you might do better. At least you have a fighting chance. But if you exercise regularly, and, you know, the basic principles, but within those confines is a lot of wiggle room for certain individuals. Like, if you don't like kale, you can still survive, like things like that, you know. Or if, you know, if you're really have low cholesterol and are underweight, or you're fine with your weight and you like to have olive oil and everything, then hey, people did fine like that. And as long as you maintain an ideal body weight, then you have a good fighting chance for optimal health. That's like another big principle is to get to a healthy weight and stay there, because that does determine risk for chronic disease as well. And I just think oil is such an easy way to cut out hundreds or thousands of calories that it's just it's a no-brainer for most people. I mean, it's harder to, you have to relearn how to cook a little bit, and it's hard to eat out. But the idea, or the accepting of that fact that it's so beneficial, is pretty simple.
Right. And when you look at just, you know, expand on the idea of oil as energy and look at the way we use energy now. So I spent a year when I was 20, I spent a year in Jerusalem, and I lived near Mount Gethsemane, which is, you know, quite well known in Christian circles as, you know, the place where I think Jesus was captured by the Romans. And so, you know, there's a lot of pilgrimage there. It turns out that Gethsemane is Greek for two Hebrew words, Gat Shemen, which means oil press. And there's all these olive trees there. And I went to visit the oil press, and it was these two giant stones, circular stones, one on top of the other. And it was, you know, drawn by oxen. And you know how little olive oil they would get for the amount of energy they put in? Like, this stuff was precious.
Right.
Like, you know, if you had a bit of olive oil, it was like a celebration. Like, you know, that's why it was so important to the diet. It's not because, you know, the same reason that sort of meat became important to the diet. It was like, you know, the celebratory hunt was a special occasion. It wasn't what you had every single day.
That is such an interesting perspective. I love that. That's so true. I mean, and then think about all that waste of all the olive, all the good stuff that they're just throwing away just to get that precious olive oil. If you think about it, energy wise, it's just not efficient. That's a great, great addition. I wish I thought of that to put in the book.
Yeah. Well, and I think it was related to the you know, the way you could keep the, you know, it was you took your olives and of course you pickled or brined them to have them last, and you know, the ones that were too young for that you could turn into oil. Like, it was a very efficient way of harvesting the resources from that land. And when, you know, there's certainly lush areas of the Mediterranean, but a lot of the Mediterranean is, you know, you look at it and you say, well, how can they grow anything there? These very hilly, rocky, like olive trees are one of the things that really do well there.
Right. No, it's true. It's true. It's very interesting, the climate.
You know, and for us to drink all this olive oil because it's healthy is like, you know, well, I get my water from Fiji because, you know, because right. Who doesn't want water from 12,000 miles away, right?
No, right. And I mean, that's another element that adds to the whole argument of thinking about where our food is coming from. We're so detached nowadays. You know, we don't know where our food, like if you get, like if you look at a Happy Meal or whatever, like who knows, you can't even imagine where half of those ingredients started from. And you know, and how they ended up on your paper wrapper. Like, it's just, it's such a, people don't think about it. We don't need to think about it. We can absolutely easily get through our lives without knowing where our food comes from. But how beautiful to know where our food comes from and actually start thinking about it again. And I think it makes you appreciate food more and appreciate nature and your body more. I think it's a wonderful kind of, a wonderful thing to adopt, another principle that we should kind of start teaching our children. I mean, I know I try to emphasize that with my kids, and it's hard in urban society, but I think that's an important lost art.
We had a bit of fun over the holidays. One of our family holiday gifts was a mushroom growing kit, and it was just this sort of block of something, and it had the oyster mushroom spores in it. So, you know, my son took it out of the box and just, you know, wet it every day, and it grew like, you know, a quarter pound of oyster mushrooms. And like, you know, I'll never look at oyster mushrooms again the same way, because now,
and you're too, right?
Like, now I kind of have an intimacy with them. Like, I know a little bit. And obviously it was, you know, a package. It wasn't from the wild, but it was one step closer to understanding something about my food.
That is so cool. I think that's so good for your kids. I tried gardening with my kids a few times, but I'm never around enough, and I live in a really bad climate to grow things. But they were so excited about it. And when you could see something and grow it and then eat it, there's just such a new connection that we don't normally have anymore. Most of us don't. I mean, a lot of people still do. But I know here in Los Angeles, it's not very common.
Yeah, no. And still, you know, even when you know exactly how it works, if you keep a sense of wonder about it, you'll go out in the field that you sowed, or the, you know, the garden plot, or the paper cup on the windowsill, and you see that thing come up, it's a miracle. Like, it seems so unlikely.
It is. It's so cool. I agree. I love that. It's beautiful.
You know, and so I guess a lot of the Mediterranean society is still very much aware. Like, they, you know, they have to grow their own food. They have to put in the work. That it's not a given. Like, we have a real, like, I think it's a false sense, but we certainly have a sense of food security as a society, that food is always there. You just go to the supermarket, and the only time we get nervous is when there's a big storm and everyone's like, you know, bread and eggs and milk, bread and eggs. But basically we feel like, you know, the supermarket with its tins and boxes and cans and packages has everything we need, and there's nothing to worry about. And I think there's something a little bit invigorating about living close enough to your food supply to worry about it.
That's true. Yeah, that is so true. And it's sad. You know, I've worked in places where they're in the middle of a food desert, and, you know, the closest thing they have are fast food places, and that's all they have access to. And I think that's so tragic, because you're right. I love that whole movement right now to do the neighborhood gardens, you know, where they're doing the community, I think it's called community gardens, where people are participating, and people are, you know, building up these gardens in the middle of those food deserts and making, you know, that connection to food and having access to actual healthy food. And I really hope that continues and builds, and especially in those neighborhoods that don't have access like a lot of us do.
Right. And I think your book is part of the movement to reconnect people with their food heritage, because there's nobody on this planet who doesn't come from a healthy food heritage. If you go back three generations, if you go back to 1945, there was no, you know, there was no such thing as an unhealthy food society. The unhealthy people
I'd have to argue like Eastern Europe, which is my roots. I mean, and even if you look at the 7-country study, they're the ones that did the worst.
Okay, maybe we have to go back. But you know what? I'll argue right back with you that the peasantry ate pretty well, right? Carrots, cabbage, potatoes.
Yes,
and
true.
Tiny true. Bits of, you know, schmaltz.
Schmaltz.
But you know, when we come over to this country, what we tend to take, what we again, looks like the olives. What we end up really longing for are those very special foods that you could get. You know, on Friday afternoon, the Jews would get something a little special. They'd get a small piece of salmon. They'd get, you know, a little chicken liver. Something that they would not be able to afford. And those are the foods we now celebrate as our cultural heritage.
Right. That's a big part of my book too, is that when we had meat throughout every time until the last 50, 60 years, it was so small because it was special, and it was like the royalty had it, and the most affluent people were able to afford that because it was not meat was not commodifiable as it is now, or, you know, 3 meals a day as a hunk of meat on your plate. Like, that was never like that. It was never the case, which is part of the argument that the Mediterranean diet is healthy because it was plant-based, because the majority of the calories were coming from plants. So you're right. Exactly. Around the world.
Right. So, you know, I've talked about this with Chef Brian Terry, who wrote, you know, Afro-Vegan, around the same, you know, the African-American community. If you go back 2 generations, there was a farmer. There was greens and, you know, sweet potatoes and fruit, and you know, every cultural heritage has a place to be proud of that is really health promoting.
Isn't that fascinating? I mean, we have no food culture in America. I've been talking about that recently. Wanting to, you know, make it into, we need to develop a food culture because it's nice to have this diversity and everything, but we don't have a culture around food itself, like in the United States. You know, there's some little, you know, sparkles, like if you go to the South, you get Southern cuisine, or if you, you know, but really it's just this wonderful hodgepodge of different diverse cultures throughout our food around the country. But it would be so nice to have culture around eating and going back to connecting to nature and making our food and all of that. I think I wish that we could start teaching that in our school system, and, you know, at least parent to child, but, you know, generationally, because we've lost that connection. And I think that that would make such a difference in our children's lives and in the future of our healthcare.
What do you think that would look like? An American food culture?
Right. It's funny because I've been working on trying to define that. And I think it would look like something where you're learning about gardening and you're learning about, you know, I really do think we need to connect back with nature somehow. And I sound so hippy dippy, and I'm telling you, I'm so LA urban, but I feel this need. I think we all need to remember where, you know, our earth and where food comes from and how it's grown. And our children need to see that and experience that. And I'm sure, I know a lot of people do, but a lot of people on the other hand don't. So I think that would be part of it, is incorporating teaching where food comes from, how to garden, how to make food, how, you know, grains are made, like just to have a deeper discussion about food within our educational system, starting at the beginning, instead of just being, you know, food industry supported. Like, we definitely get tons of education on how important dairy is for our bones starting in preschool. And that's just because it's funded by the industry, right? So we're that's the only food, only nutrition information we really get as children. And I think that we need to start learning about nutrition because it's so important. It's a matter of us being cognizant in school, you know, and all this like ADD and ADHD and all of this stuff now, because we're just our kids are eating so poorly. I think it's so important from a cognitive and a health growth and, you know, just a minimization of this crazy rampant chronic disease. If we could start it young, it would be hugely empowering.
As you're talking, it suddenly occurred to me. So I'm about to take this podcast into PG-13 territory. But when I was in graduate school studying health education, one of the things I thought I wanted to be was a sex educator. And I was really turned off at the way sex education was being taught, and that it was being taught in terms of reductionism. It was, you know, how do you avoid diseases? How do you avoid pregnancy? It was all, it was just like, you know, how do you not get heart disease? How do you, you know, how much calcium do you need? And where do you get calcium? And there was nothing about pleasure. And I think the way we teach food is we don't think of it as pleasurable. How could you, you know, how could we have a pleasurable food culture and we're eating 7-Eleven, you know, hot dogs in the car because we can eat them one-handed?
Right. Right. That's such a good point.
That we need, you know, if we want to change the way people respond to food, we can't just keep beating them over the head with health facts. We have to make them understand that they're missing out on pleasure.
I love that. I mean, and you could, what about bringing back cooking to school? You know, kids don't learn how to cook, and it doesn't have to be just, I think it shouldn't be just the girls. I think everyone should learn how to cook. Like, we should have food prep courses. And I mean, it's just like lifestyle. Like, I really want to transform everything in the education system. I love that too. You're right about sex education, because it became such a horrible taboo, scary topic that you're like scared. You have to sign, your parents have to sign a waiver that you could learn about your body. It's like, what? Mm-hmm. That's just how my body is, and I should be ashamed of it. You're right. That's such a good point. But what about, changing that and changing the way we talk about learning about food, learning about business? I mean, nobody knows how to get out of school and make a living. And, you know, now it's so hard with the job market, and everything's changing in that regard too. So, I mean, we really need to step up how we teach our children. And I mean, I don't even know how that, it's so bureaucratic and deep and sewn together. It's like, I can't imagine penetrating that market and trying to like make some of those broad changes. I guess that's why there's such a big movement for homeschooling nowadays.
Right. I was going to say, we dropped out of the system a number of years ago. And then
that was smart. And then that was very smart.
It was. And so now my son has to take these standardized tests. So it's kind of fun to look at, like, for math, like the gap between like what he needs to know to function in the world and what he needs to know for this test. Like, you know, so we have to go over like, you know, isosceles triangles. Like, when was the last time, you know, the properties of an isosceles triangle were important in your life?
Right. Never. Absolutely never. Right. I mean, unless you're, you know, an architect or an engineer where it does matter, but then that would be something more specialized. Right. If we could broaden it out to be more life oriented, that would be so extraordinary.
Right. So let's give some people some home ec right now. So one of the sections of the book that I liked the best was, of course, the recipes. So you have a ton of great recipes in there, and they come with an amazing pedigree, right? You just didn't sort of pick stuff off the internet.
No. It was the hardest thing I ever did. I always have to remind everyone that I'm not a chef, because it is so much harder for me to get in the kitchen and really figure out what I'm doing, because I don't really know what I'm doing. I just kind of play in the kitchen. But it was very challenging to take the olive oil out and the animal products of classic recipes. But I was on a mission. I was going to do it. And like, there were certain ones that were really challenging, like the falafel, because I love falafel, but I didn't want all the, it's deep fried. Traditionally, it's deep fried. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to make it stick and not burn without the oil. So that went through many generations of test runs. But yeah, they're all traditional. So a lot of Middle Eastern style dishes, because I spent a couple sessions with my ex-mother-in-law in the kitchen, kind of doing, like taking some of her classic recipes because she's from Egypt. And so we would kind of take some of her, she's a really good cook. And so, you know, I would watch her, and she doesn't measure, and I'm not good at measuring either. So she would just throw a little there, but I would force her. I'm like, here, no, measure this. And we're measuring together, and I was trying to document everything. And then she, you know, of course, uses olive oil all the time. And so it was very challenging for her to think in my constrict, you know, I was very restrictive to her. But it was so fun, because she's such a magician in the kitchen. So it was really fun to kind of apply my crazy principles and see how we came up with stuff together. So it was a really cool experience. We got a few recipes together. She's the one that mastered, which I think was insane. I would have never done this on my own. The dolmas and the stuffed cabbage and the stuffed, what's the other one? There's another stuffed, the three stuffed ones that were so, they're so challenging to make, but she, oh my gosh, she's such a master with flavor that it didn't miss, you won't miss the olive oil at all. She's so good.
And dolmas is stuffed grape leaves, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
I need to do that because I that's one of my big addictions. And I try to pretend that the stuff they're drenched in isn't oil.
Right. Like, I'll tell you, it's not easy. It's not an easy recipe. This is not something I do every week. Like this is like you're having a special occasion type of recipe. But I have, you know, there's the other. So I did. There's a few of those. Only a few of those because I don't like difficult recipes. I don't have time for them as a busy mom. So the majority of the recipes are very simple ones, like chili. Like I have this chili that I make every week in that book. And and one of my favorite recipes that I worked on also with her was the baked oat bread. So I made a gluten-free, oil-free, vegan bread so it was really challenging because, you know, working with yeast, I'm not good at that. And it's such a chemistry experiment, but we finally got it down. It was like, we were jumping up and down. We were so excited after like the 10th try. And so I was excited to have a bread cause I'm gluten-free and it's hard to find a healthy gluten-free bread.
Uh-huh.
So I was excited about that one.
Cool. So how has your cooking changed or what have you added or, you know, shifted since you got into vegetarian?
Well, that's the thing. I've always kind of made this type of food. Like I've always gravitated towards this type of food anyway. So like I'm a hummusaholic, love anything with hummus. So I have like two hummuses in there. And I mean, that's just, I've incorporated some of these new recipes I just kind of modified stuff that I've always made traditionally. Like I just kind of gravitate towards this type of food anyway. And, but I've been like, there's a couple recipes in there that I make I make that hummus, the hummus of the earth, I called it because it's very earthy, but I have that in my fridge all the time. And I make that the hearty red lentil chili all the time. And there's a few soups in there, but my whole idea was that I wanted everything to be simple and it was fun. I was worried I wasn't going to have enough recipes because it was so hard for me. And I was also trying to, you know, do all the writing and history. And so this was a big passion project for me. This took a lot of work, but so I was worried I wasn't going to have enough recipes. So I was so lucky because I was able to engage Chad Sarno and Robin Robertson. They gave me a few recipes too. So I have some of their amazing, some of their beautiful work inside the recipe section as well. So we ended up with a total of 66 recipes, which I didn't expect. So that was exciting.
Wow. So any spices or anything that you have come to like and appreciate that you maybe didn't use so much before?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yes, yes, there is. I'm in love with, my favorite spice now is smoked paprika.
Ah.
And I put that together with chipotle and with cumin a lot. And we use a lot of turmeric. There's a lot of, which is also very healthful. All the spices are healthy, but turmeric is kind of popular these days. And so there's a lot of turmeric in everything, which adds a lot of flavor and color and health properties. So there is a lot of those are like the biggest ones that we use kind of in everything. And a lot of chili pepper flakes and but those are the classic. And of course, there's always onion and garlic. And I have an intolerance to onion and garlic. So I always had to test them without and with. So it was kind of, that was challenging too, because I know a lot of people love the onion and garlic. And that's very standard staple in Mediterranean cooking. But so, you know, anyone, by the way, if anyone's listening and you like more, you might want to add more because I kind of went on the lower end. I gave a broad range for the garlic always, but I'm not a good tester for that part.
Right. Like for me, the phrase too much garlic doesn't make sense. You know, I'll just cock my head like a puppy. Like, huh? What does that even mean?
A lot of people are like that. I understand. It's good. I love it.
So let's tackle myth number two, which is wine.
Wine. Okay. Well, I do have a bias. I do love wine. But I know that you're only supposed to have one glass for women maximum a day and two glasses, or I should say servings per day for men. And that's just to avoid cancer and all that stuff. So the myth is that the red wine, like the olive oil, is the reason for the success of the Mediterranean diet. But really, it's just when you look at it, it really is just another way to get phytochemicals into the diet. And you're just as fine doing, you know, grapes, the intact grapes. It's kind of like the wine is to grapes what the olive oil is to the olive. And it's just, you know, but You know, there are some studies showing that alcohol, because it's relaxing, can be cardioprotective, but that's in the small doses. So I was trying to be very, very cautious with my wording here, because I don't want people to be encouraged, like I'm encouraging alcohol consumption, because I'm not. But I am saying that if you are going to do it, of course, don't be pregnant or driving or, you know, with liver disease or any of those things. And, you know, drink responsibly. I kept saying that. But it's on the tip of my pyramid on the top, because it's an optional. It is part of the Mediterranean traditional diet, and you can incorporate it in those small doses. And does it make or break the diet? I don't think so at all.
And I love that approach, because there's, you know, I see so many approaches to dietary excellence that are sort of hard lines in the sand. Like, you know, you do this and you're going to hell.
Right.
And I think there are communities for whom that is appropriate. People who have had a serious, you know, cardiovascular event. People who are addicted, obviously, you know, you mentioned that people who are alcoholics shouldn't be having wine. People who are food addicts shouldn't even have tiny bits. But for most people, learning to live in, you know, true moderation, not what our culture calls moderation, but not having hard and fast lines, but having just excellent patterns, is really important. I think that's one of the takeaways I'm getting from the vegetarian diet, is that this is an overall pattern. It's not a rigid set of rules.
Exactly. That is what I really want the takeaway to be, is that it doesn't have to be perfect. Nobody has to be perfect to be healthy and to have this lifestyle. It's just make it your own and make it what works for you, because that's when you'll do it. It's not when it's something rigid and lines drawn in the sand that's going to be exciting to people. It's going to be like, oh gosh, I have to give up this and I can't do that. No, you know, just try to do as much of this as you can and make it work for you. That's really important.
Right. Any other recipes, names of dishes you want to just whet our appetites with? Anything else that you of the 66 that are real favorites of yours or other people have said they love?
Yeah, well, another one that I've kind of become, I have also once a week, are these cheesy smoky butternut squash pasta. It's like a nacho-y cheese, like really warm mac and cheese, but spicy. So I love that. And I love the shakshuka. It's basically like a Middle Eastern tofu scramble. It would be like eggs. They normally make it with eggs, but this is with tofu and just a lot of Mediterranean vegetables. So I love that for breakfast. And I'm flipping through to remember the ones that I don't make that often. Mujadara is kind of like a very classic vegan dish. You know, it's just lentils and rice baked. But my mother-in-law added this amazing garnish that was to die for, with like orange and cinnamon and onion that she fried up at the end and threw it on top. I was like blown away. I've never seen that before. And then I love the polenta with mushroom ragu, because I love mushrooms. I got to try making my mushrooms like you did. But then there's like three of them that are hard to make, like the moussaka and the stuffed vegetables. Those are just a little bit more challenging. Actually, the moussaka is not that bad, but just a few extra steps. Everything else is really simple. Like I have very simple, I love simple recipes. A few salads, hot salads, tabbouleh. We have two tabbouleh. We have a gluten-free quinoa one. And then there's a regular traditional Arabic one. Couscous soup. That was fun. Hot lentil soup. Yeah. Oh, and I love Chad's Caesar dressing. I asked him for a Caesar dressing that was oil-free, and it's so good. It's so good.
Ooh, what does he use for flavoring?
He uses, okay, let me get to that. I just had it there. It was, well, he uses like the seaweed flakes for the kind of the fishy, you know, what's it called? Because it's usually
the anchovies.
Anchovies, exactly. Thank you. But he uses, let me see. I'm trying to find that. He's so talented, that guy. I have a breakfast salad. That was fun. Where's his salad? I just had it.
Oh yeah, you know, the one, and I don't have the book in front of me. I mentioned before we got on, started recording that I was reading it this morning and I left it somewhere. So I gotta go yes. Back for it. But the first one I was going to make was the breakfast, the dinner pancakes.
Oh, I love those. I love those. Those are so fun to make and they're so easy and they're so good. You shred up the vegetables and I used, chickpea flour, which I just started experimenting with, but it was so hearty. I love that.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm looking.
I've been using that for. I saw a recipe Anne and Jane Esselstyn's cookbook that was kind of a chickpea flour omelet.
Oh, I have to look for that. I haven't read that book yet. Okay, so he uses the sea vegetable granules and a natural, and then a miso paste and nutritional yeast and Dijon mustard and lemon and white wine vinegar and cashews. It's a cashew. Oh, it's so good.
Oh, okay. That sounds great.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to end the call before talking about the longest chapter in the book, I think, is where you teach people how to actually take the steps they need to incorporate this whole food, plant-based, vegetarian diet into their lives. So I just wanted to acknowledge that for folks, that this isn't just a book of philosophy and recipes. There is a ton of nuts and bolts stuff. So one of the things that I took away that I didn't realize is you say that silicone bakeware is one of the healthiest types of bakeware you can get.
It's a great one because, by the way, thank you for mentioning that, because that is important, because no matter how much information you have and how much you know why something is good, it doesn't matter unless you do it. And so I did spend a lot of time, and I have a lot of tactics and techniques and tips on how to implement all of this. But the silicone I like because for oil-free baking, it doesn't stick. Like anything could pop out of that. I learned about that from Chef AJ, but it works. They work. I love that stuff. It's harder to find, but it's worth it. And they last a long time.
Huh? Because I do a lot of baking, and the bakeware that I have, it's either it was like no stick before I knew that, you know, I shouldn't be using like Teflon stuff, you know, or it's disgusting.
Right,
you know, like this, like, you know, 30-year-old stainless steel cookie trays, or we just put parchment paper on everything, which works for some things, but you know, it leaves a lot of stuff on the parchment paper. So I'm very excited to try like some of the muffin or cupcake recipes with some silicone bakeware.
Yeah, I mean, I use parchment paper too sometimes for my old cookie sheets, because I don't have I have the Silpat, but instead of cleaning them, sometimes I'll just use the parchment. But yeah, I think you let us know what you think about that, because I think it's really a great tool. I love them.
Yeah, and it's nice to know, because I wasn't sure, because you know, I've seen it and it feels very sort of like floppy and plasticky, and my reaction was, oh, this can't be good for me.
Right, except it's inert. It's not plastic. It's an inert chemical, so it's safe. It doesn't leach anything into the food. That's why I like it so much.
Yeah,
so, and it comes in all these different shapes and sizes, so it's great. And literally anything will pop out of it. It's the coolest thing ever.
All right, shopping spree coming up.
All right, yay! Yeah. I know, I need some new ones too.
Yeah, so you know, because there's sometimes where I feel like, you know, the oil-free community is trying to sell me on nonstick. Like, well, it's bad. It's not that bad. And I have to end up deciding who I believe. Sort of like the Mercola folks who are all into like BPA and chemical additives, or the plant-based people who are so into we should eat the right food that however we can make it easy to do, we will. And it feels like,
oh, but you could totally do, but you could totally have the best of both worlds. I mean, stainless steel does really well, you know, like those pancakes you're talking about. Uh-huh. I make those on a stainless steel pan and it pops off. So, you know, if you have a good, it doesn't have to be the Teflon stuff. Like, I'm scared of that. I'm convinced on that too. I think that nobody should be using that stuff, but I don't think you need to cook oil free. I don't.
Cool. All right. I'm going to try the pancakes on stainless steel and let you know how it goes.
Okay, let me know how it goes. The other thing is, I haven't found a rice cooker yet that doesn't have the Teflon. It's hard to find everything. And I don't know of a griddle too. That's really hard.
Miracle Pot. I'll send you a link. I have one. It's a rice cooker that's just stainless steel insert.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Good to know.
I got it on Amazon like 10 years ago for $50. I assume they still make it. It was the only one that was, it wasn't no stick.
Awesome. Oh, I'm totally going to go get one. Thank you.
Because, you know, we go over to people's houses and they would have those, you know, this beautiful meal, and there'd be like rice in the rice cooker. And then when you get to the bottom, you see like the bottom of the rice cooker is like two different colors. There's where the Teflon's come off and where it hasn't yet. And I'm like, oh.
Yeah, I just threw out a pan like that too. I still am getting rid of my mine like that. It's so hard to get rid of, you know, but it's gross. It's so bad for you. I've read a lot of stuff on that. It is bad.
Right. Well, just get your kids to like cut vegetables on it and then you'll have to throw it out.
Yeah, right. No, but then it's going to go into the vegetables.
Just throw them out.
Oh, yeah. Just for practice.
So, what have you got coming up? You've got this book out. I assume you're busy promoting it. What's up for you, in the next few weeks and months?
Well, it's a good question. I'm doing a webinar on Sunday with Whitney Lauritsen, Eco Vegan Gal. We're doing a How to Go Vegan, like 6-hour webinar that we're putting so much into. We're doing an ebook and all that for that. So that we're excited about that. It's essentialveganguide.com. And I'm going to start teaching classes. I realize I do a lot of nutrition counseling one-on-one, but I'm ready to start kind of just teaching some small classes for people that are in Los Angeles. I'm thinking about how to best format that. I'm looking for locations, and that's something that's on my radar that I'm trying to implement. I wanted to do it in January because it's such a time to everyone is all motivated, but I just need to figure out all the details. And I've got I'm working for this company called Cheft, and it's a new startup like Blue Apron where they oh, you know about this. So you're doing one.
I'm not involved in it at the moment, but I know this space very well.
Okay. So yeah, so it's kind of like that, but it's not all vegan. So I'm doing the vegan recipes for them. Like I think we have 3 of my meal kits that'll be going out, and that's launching in March. Mm-hmm. And then I'm hopefully starting this other food line thing, but that's been taking a while, so I don't know what's going on with that. And just seeing a lot of clients, this has been like my big thing, and trying to get some, you know, I've got some talks coming up, and I don't know, and that's what's solid right now. I've got other stuff that are potentially going to happen, but I can't really talk about them yet because okay. I don't know yet.
Gotcha. So is there another part of the world that you want to explore culinary wise?
Yes. What a good question. I know I need to go to Asia because why is Okinawa so successful? And I just want to learn how to cook Asian food.
Wow, you're taking bullets for all of us.
I think I might. I don't know. It's sad. I've got another idea for a book too. So I'm trying to, of course, it's so funny because the book comes out and you know, you know how it is. You're working on a book. You're like, oh, I'll never do this again. This is so hard. Why am I doing this? It's like giving birth, and then you give birth and it's like, oh, what am I going to do next? Yeah. You know, like you can't wait to do the next. It's like having kids.
Except once you've given birth to a book, you don't have to get up at night for it.
That's right. It might be more intense than labor. Well, I don't know if it's more intense, but it's once it's out, it's out. So I'm trying to figure out the next book, but it's kind of nice to not be writing right now. I'm writing all these little articles here and there, so it's not like I'm not writing, but, mm-hmm. But you know, a book is a huge to-do, and I'm really excited about this one because really this is the first time I ever got personal. You know, I talk about why I'm vegan and I get to interview like the world's leading experts on all the wonderful ethical parts, like Melanie Joy talking about carnism and Richard Oppenlander talking about the environmental implications and Jean Bauer and factory farming. Like that chapter, I don't know, Howard, I'm sure you've had these experiences, but this was like the first time where I had experienced what I've heard about that myth called flow. When you have writer's flow, I had this one chapter 3 where I started typing and I just couldn't type fast enough and I'm crying and my heart is pouring onto the page. And it was the most exciting experience of writing I've ever had in my life. So this book I'm excited about. I feel like I really did put my heart and soul in it and I'm very excited to get it out there. And so thank you for sharing it with your audience.
Yeah, well, I will say that, you know, I'm quite a literary snob. And I love that your book is really well written. It's well written. It's not just good information. It's not just, oh, you know, you have a happy personality, but it's literary. And on top of that, it's got great information and your great personality comes across in it. But it's easy to read.
You just totally made me happy. Thank you. What an honor comes from you. Thank you.
And you know, it's funny that you say like this is the book in which you kind of, you know, shared your soul. There's something, you know, really profound to at a certain point, and I guess in a writer's career, where they stop trying to be commercial or be strategic, and they just let it all hang out. You know, like this is who I am. You know, deal with it.
Yes, you know what? That's exactly what I was doing. And it was so scary. And I mean, it feels very raw and naked and vulnerable to do that. Like, I was a little scared to put it out there. And, you know, especially because, I mean, as a dietitian, you know, people don't want to hear about the other reasons and the ethical things. And I was, but it's so, it means so much to me that I'm like, you know what? It's part of it. It all goes together. And here's why. So it does feel very naked. And, but here it is. Here I am. Take right. me or leave me.
Well, I think, and there's something very transparent about doing that, that I really appreciate. You know, I'm personally am not an ethical vegan. I eat like one, but in turn, you know, philosophically, I don't toe the party line. So I'm very sensitive to when people are in danger of, or perceived of, or may actually be subjugating their research agenda to a vegan agenda. Like when you said at the beginning, you went to see if olive oil was healthy. You didn't go in looking to prove that olive oil was or wasn't. And I don't think there's nothing wrong with having a vegan agenda, but I see it sometimes as, I want to say, not stated up front. And so, you know, as if the person could have come to any other conclusion. And so I actually find it very disarming. And you know, it's easy to engage with you because this is where you're coming from. And at the same time, you're not, you know, by knowing that, you're not letting it blinder you to research. You're looking at the research, looking for the truth, not looking to justify a philosophy.
Right. Wow. Yeah. Thank you for saying that. Exactly. I want to be in integrity with everything that I say. I don't want to say anything in an exaggerated way. I'm very careful about that on social media too, because for that very reason, like it's only going to hurt what I believe in. It's only going to hurt the vegan movement to compromise the integrity by saying something that's false, you know, or misleading. It's a very interesting wire to walk, because you do have the bias, but you also really want to be in integrity, scientifically speaking. So it is very interesting.
Right. And, you know, and to be exaggerating or, you know, cherry picking, it implies weakness, right? It implies that you're not really confident that the rest of the data is making your case. Like
absolutely,
plant-based people should be really relaxed. Like, you know, just when you look at the preponderance of every different kind of data versus, you
right.
know, paleo or Atkins or standard American, there's really, you know, there's no contest. And yet we're all like up in arms and nervous about things.
Well, because everyone expects us to prove it to a different level. I think because of what you implied, because of this perceived bias. So people are like, yeah, right, prove it. Because it's also not the standard way of us being taught. And it's also not the way, you know, the nutrition community is taught. I mean, the USDA is sponsored. It's all sponsored. So that's what we're taught. So, we're always constantly feeling like we have to defend our views because it's not commonplace. So that's another kind of huge element that people need to consider, that you're right. The evidence is there. And that's what I wanted to show in this book, that the evidence is there. It was there. It's there in the Mediterranean. It's there in all the cardiovascular studies that we've seen from the 50s and 60s and 70s and now up till now. And we really do have that evidence. And it's wonderful, because for me, all of my values that I initially were so passionate about as a kid, but didn't understand and was scared that it wasn't healthy, it all beautifully, symbiotically came together. And I like to call it a symbiotic trifecta, where it is best for the animals, it is best for the environment, and it is also best for us. And I love that. I just think that means it's such a universal truth, because it's best for all. And I love that we have this evidence that's growing. And I wanted to document that very cautiously in this book, to add that scientific basis for it.
Right. Well, you do a beautiful job. And, you know, knowing the science the way you do, it comes across very clearly that you really respect research, and you respect researchers, and you respect truth in all its forms. And so, you know, I didn't get the feeling like you were cherry picking, or you were, you know, purposefully, you know, averting your eyes from alternate types of evidence. You do provide evidence that counters some of the things you say.
Right? Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So that's, to me, that's very trustworthy. That's an approach that welcomes me in, as opposed to, you know, turning me into a zealot.
Right. Oh, thank you, Howard. I'm so grateful to hear that. Thank you. I know. I remember when I gave the book to Dr. Campbell and I was like, oh God, oh God, oh God, here we go. I was so nervous because I have such, he's like my hero. And he loved it. And I was so happy. Like it just, that was like, after that, I felt like I literally put the book down. I'm like, okay, I'm done. I could be out there. And because he's so critical and scientific and so, he's so analytical and he knows his research so well that I feel like if I could get him to agree and it was on board, then I felt like I was that was like, okay. I was so happy.
The ultimate editor.
The ultimate editor, exactly. So, no, I know peer review is important because it's a commercial book. It's not going into a journal, but I wanted it to be scientifically as accurate as possible. So I did put it through a severe peer review and I was, you know, I went through a few people, Dr. Greger and Brenda Davis and Dr. Kent, like everyone. So that are really science oriented and know all of the research behind this. And I want this, so this book is peer reviewed in that kind of sense. I mean, it's not a technical journal, but I wanted it to be close to that.
Right. So all the stuff that your editors didn't let you put in because it was boring, is that available on your blog? Does that exist in a public format anyway?
Maybe I should. There was so much of that science that I had to fight. I'm like, please, please, please. We have to keep that. I should go back and look at the earlier edits and see. I would have to go kind of pick it out because it's been extracted through different, you know, stations, but that's a good idea.
Yeah, make a director's cut of the books. You know, 900 pages. You could press tofu with it.
Okay, I love it. For people that like to geek out on nutrition like me, I should do that. It's a good idea.
Right. So for people who are meeting you for the first time in this interview, how can they stay in touch with you?
Oh, great. Okay. Please find me on, my website is plantbaseddietitian.com. And I'm very active and I answer all the messages I get on Facebook on Plant-Based Dietitian, my Plant-Based Dietitian page, and on Twitter as Plant Dietitian. And anywhere you could find me, I try to respond to absolutely everything. And if I don't, then write again, because sometimes I miss things. But I want to support people. You know, my day job is counseling and I love helping people one-on-one, and I'm going to start teaching all these classes because I really just want people to see how easy this is. And it's changed my life. I've seen it change personally. I've seen hundreds of people's lives change. And I hope to help anyone else that's interested and open-minded.
Right on. Right on. You know, so for going from someone who honed her craft playing Juliet, you know, a teenage girl who died from what she put in her mouth, to an adult who saves people. It's quite a journey.
Oh, when you put it like that, that's hilarious. I love it.
So Juliana, thank you so much for agreeing to be on the podcast a second time. And the book is called The Vegetarian Diet. It's available everywhere books are sold. I highly recommend it. And I wish you only good things in the future. And I can't wait to read about your Okinawa book.
Thank you so much, Howard. You're the best.
All right, be well.
You too.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Juliana Hever, the plant-based dietitian, author of The Vegetarian Diet. You can get that book wherever fine books are sold. Upcoming podcasts include next week Ann Bradney, the founder of Radical Aliveness Institute, talking about radical aliveness and how we can achieve such a thing. And for the 2 weeks following, we're going to be talking to folks about fitness, about exercise physiology. Martin Gibala, who is one of the premier researchers on HIIT, high intensity interval training, and he'll be talking about his latest findings, including the fact that we may need a lot less exercise than we thought for a lot of health benefits if we just do it right. Following that is Lani Muehlrath, who will be making her second appearance on the Plant Yourself podcast, talking about how exercise is often the missing piece in comprehensive lifestyle change. So stay tuned for those two. If you're enjoying the podcast, the best thing you can do to help me out is tell all your friends, share the links, and leave a review on iTunes so that other people can find out about it and the mission can continue. Thanks very much, and be well, my friends.
Let's take this home with some gratitude. First of all, thanks to Mama Earth. You have been so very, very good to me. Second, Will Ridenour donated the use of his beautiful song Sabali Dawn as the theme music for this show. You can find out more about Will's music at willridenour.com. Third, thanks to all the patrons of the Plant Yourself podcast for your financial support. You can read the names of all the patrons at any show notes at plantyourself.com. If you would like to become a patron to show your gratitude for the work I'm doing and help support it, you can do so at plantyourself.com/gift. That's G-I-F-T, all lowercase. And finally, I want to thank you, the listener, for making all of this possible, for giving me a reason to reach out to people, to have conversations, to edit, produce, publicize. All the stuff that I do is for you, so that we can continue to have conversations and continue to ripple out healing and transformation into the world.